Welcome to Creating Wealth with Jason Hartman. During this program, Jason is going to tell you some really exciting things that you probably haven't thought of before, and a new slant on investing. Fresh new approaches to America's best investment that will enable you to create more wealth and happiness than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine, self-made multimillionaire who not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. He's been a successful investor for 20 years and currently owns properties in 11 states and 17 cities. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to financial freedom. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is episode number 250, and this is your host, Jason Hartman. Thank you so much for joining me today. Well, we just concluded our Meet the Masters event a couple of days ago in Southern California, and it was fantastic. We'll have a little debrief for you about that in a moment, but before we get to that, I just wanted to share a couple of things. We're not going to have much time to talk today because I've got our guest, and this is a 10th show, of course, so what does that mean when it's a 10th show? Well, we're going to talk about a non-financial, non-economic, non-real estate topic. And we have David Rock today. And David Rock talks about your brain at work and how to focus, avoid distractions, and use that magical thing within all of us that you may or may not have heard of, but I heard of it many years ago from Dennis Waitley, I believe, was the original person that told me about this. And it is called, get this, your reticular activating system. What is that? Well, that's the filter that we all have built in so that it filters out sensory stimulation so we don't have sensory overload and we can focus on what we need to focus on. So that's the reticular activating system, and we'll talk about that a little bit and many other things with our guest, David Rock. And before we get to that, you know, it's interesting. Now that I live in Arizona, I have little interest in Orange County business. However, I do still get the Orange County Business Journal, and as I was about to put it in the round file after I got it out of my mailbox the other day, I noticed an article, because I always kind of skim it real quick before I toss it, and I noticed an article that I thought I'd share with you. And you know how I'm always talking about the three dimensions of real estate and how income property is a multidimensional asset class? Well, this actually almost talks about a whole nother dimension, and there are really more than three dimensions, of course. That's just my catchy name for the basic or the most significant three dimensions of real estate, and that's why I call that module that name. But what's interesting here is on the front page of the Orange County Business Journal, March 19th issue, an article says, apartment rents still hot, sales cool, trend has recent buyers building. Okay, so this is kind of another dimension I just want to touch on here. And I won't read the whole article to you and bore you with my reading and voiceover skills here, but just to touch on a few things here. It says, Orange County's once red-hot market for apartment sales appears to have lost some steam over the past year, and signs are emerging that the rest of the country could soon follow suit. The 10 largest apartment sales here last year combined to sell for a little less than $370 million, according to data compiled by this week's Top Real Estate Deals Special Report, see list on page 40. That's a decline of about 60% from a year earlier, when the 10 largest apartment deals in OC traded for a combined $878 million. OC's decline in apartment sales comes as the general outlook for the rental market continues strong. Apartment lease rates are expected to notch a healthy increase again this year on top of a gain of 10% or more in 2011, according to recent market data. Folks, my comment, can you believe it? Apartment rents going up more than 10% in 2011, and they're expected to perform very, very well this year in 2012. Wow, was I right? Did I tell you that as people were displaced from their homes and as people couldn't take advantage, the people who couldn't take advantage of these phenomenally low interest rates because what? Their FICO scores are beat up because lenders just aren't loaning out the money because the banks are arbitraging their money, the money they took from TARP and all the various bailouts, the omnibus, etc. They're arbitraging that with treasury bills, basically no risk for them, right? So, of course, it's a total scam for us, the taxpayers, as our government gave them the money and they're not lending it. But how do we exploit the trend? We exploit it by owning income property in so many ways, not just the inflation trade that I talk about frequently on the show, but of course, inflation-induced debt destruction, my phrase for that, but in so many other ways. Continuing the article, and I'm going to have a good comment for you on this in a moment. The local trend on sales runs counter to the national trend as the economic recovery and large numbers of home foreclosures have overlapped to lift apartment prices around the U.S. So what they're talking about there is prices for buyers of apartment buildings, mostly in the large institutional deal sector in that segment of the market. And we talked about rents in the second ago, right? There are some $54 billion of apartment sales nationwide in 2011, a 50% increase from the prior year, according to data by New York-based Real Capital Analytics, a commercial property data firm. Sales of apartments were reported to be running 53% higher than a year ago levels on a national level as recently as January, according to Real Capital's data. One reason for the slowdown on apartment sales in OC, okay, now remember, they're saying Orange County has been contrary to the national trend. Now we're going to see why in a moment. One reason for the slowdown on apartment sales in OC, the market has gotten strong enough to encourage new development. Ah, that's what I'm talking about. That's another dimension. Can you imagine this? You listening can now go to jasonhartman.com and you can purchase properties in numerous markets, in diverse markets, in healthy, growing, business-friendly, landlord-friendly markets all over the United States. And you can buy them for one-third to about 60% of construction cost. When in Orange County, the rents have gotten so strong that the deals are actually penciling for people not to buy existing apartment buildings or apartment complexes, but to actually build them new from scratch. Even in places like Southern California, where environmental laws and regulations rule the day, the cost of construction is so high there. So it's actually penciling for people to build them. Now, folks, this is a major sign. This is a turning point. This is, you see rents increasing, and rents are going to increase a lot more. We talked about this a lot at our Meet the Masters event last weekend. Remember, every 1% drop in the homeownership rate equals more than 1 million new renters. Phenomenal, phenomenal opportunity for us. The article goes on to say, apartment development is on the upswing here with thousands of units in the works, particularly in Irvine, where several large projects are underway. Folks, if that isn't a sign of what is coming, I don't know what is. One more thing before we get to our debrief on Meet the Masters, we'll just talk about that for a few minutes, then we'll have our guest and we'll talk about your brain at work, how to use that amazing asset between our ears for a more successful life. So we'll get to that in a moment. But first, I just want to share a sad note, and folks, please learn the lessons I have learned the hard way. You don't have to do this yourself and learn the lesson the hard way. I've learned a lot of these lessons over the years as an investor, and many of you have, unfortunately. And that's why I say the cheapest education you'll ever get is at our live events, our home study courses at jasonhartman.com, listening to this podcast. Just learn the lessons by other people's experience rather than in the real world, because the real world is such an expensive teacher. And this is another example of that. The note says, "Dear Jason, I wish I knew about your podcast before my mother invested $150,000 in a TIC." A TIC is, of course, a tenant in common deal. That's an acronym, a tenant in common deal. In other words, that's a pooled money investment. Okay, I've talked about ticks before on the show. Before my mother invested $150,000 in a tick a few years ago. For the first year, she was doing well with it, receiving monthly payments. Eventually, the money stopped coming in, and the excuses started pouring in. They said they lost a major tenant, and, you know, usually these ticks are large commercial properties. My commentary, back to the note. They said they lost a major tenant, therefore they could not pay their investors. It was hard to get in touch with someone high up in the organization to find out what was going on, and when the investors were going to get paid. After several months of not receiving any payouts from the tick, the investors wanted to start a class action lawsuit. However, it could not be filed because the two managers of the tick could not be found. This is a case of not having control over an investment, which I know is one of your rules for investing. I have been trying to help her, but I cannot find resources to help her get out of this bad investment. Have you heard of anything like this happening to anyone? I would appreciate any advice you can give us. Thank you. Well, that is a sad story, and I'm very sorry to hear it. There have been many, many stories like that, and it is certainly not uncommon by any means. So if you can take any comfort in the fact that you're not the only one that it's happened to, it's happened to many, many people. Commandment number 3, thou shalt maintain control. Be a direct investor. Yes, you will feel some bumps in the road. You will have some problems. Nothing is foolproof. Income property, direct ownership of it, has a few problems here and there, but they are far, far less significant than the problems that can occur when you invest with somebody else in non-direct or traded investments. So the first advice I would give you is, number one, get in touch with all of the other investors. There can be strength in numbers. So it sounds like you are communicating with those other investors because you've considered filing a class action lawsuit. The thing you need to do, it's you said in your note that the two managers of the tick could not be found. Well, that may be worth hiring a private investigator. But before really even doing that, I would just go to the government. I would go to the regulators, and I would try to see if you can get someone. And again, the government usually doesn't pay attention to stuff unless it's big, okay? Or some politician or district attorney or attorney general, whatever the appropriate jurisdiction may be for this particular issue, unless they're trying to get reelected and they want to make an example out of this case or something like that. But look, the government is free. You pay taxes for a reason. So the first thing I would do is try and contact the appropriate governmental agency. Now, how do you know who to contact? The first thing to do is look at the prospectus you got with this investment, and it will reference things in there, like maybe the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, maybe FINRA. Maybe it will reference what state the entity was formed in. You can go to that state's attorney general. You can just call the FBI. Okay, there are many resources and things out there. It's probably not sold as a real estate deal, so I wouldn't necessarily, although it might have been. These ticks have been sold two different ways that I'm familiar with. One is real estate deals, and the other as securities. So securities fall under the province of the SEC and FINRA, and maybe other organizations too. But real estate falls under like the Department of Real Estate, okay, in the various state where it was formed. So I would look at the prospectus, obtain some clues from that, contact the governmental agencies. Because look, you don't have to spend any money to write a letter to the regulators and see if they will follow up on it, to make a phone call or a few phone calls. And even the FBI, takes a lot of this stuff when it goes across state lines. When it's interstate commerce, it becomes federal. So that would be another resource for you. Again, I'm sorry to hear this kind of stuff. The tick may have, if they were, you don't know exactly what happened here. It's usually a combination of three things, or a combination of at least maybe two of the three things. Number one, I always say it, why be a direct investor? Why follow my commandment number 3 of the 10 commandments of successful investing? Number 1, you might be investing with a crook. Number 2, you might be investing with an idiot. Number 3, you might be investing with someone, assuming they're honest, assuming they're competent. They take a huge management fee off the top. And you know, this might just be due to market changes. It might be a legitimate problem that they just encountered. But I will bet you dollars to donuts that before they encountered this problem, the fund managers, the people who set up the tick, skimmed a heck of a lot of money off the top for themselves. And that money might be recoverable. If they committed a criminal act, there might be some sort of insurance involved. They might have errors and omissions insurance. They might have fidelity insurance, a fidelity bond of some sort. You never know. The first step I would do, get the government involved. See if you can get the government to investigate for free and take advantage of the things we all pay taxes for. That would be my first step. After that, private investigator, talking to lawyers, etc. And again, I wish you well. I'm really sorry to hear stories like this. It just breaks my heart. And, you know, really, look, when I sold my company 6 years ago, I could have just pretty much retired. But I am so passionate about saving the middle class from these pooled asset scams out there. And even if they're not scams, just these bad deals. That's what I'm here for. And that's really my big mission in life, is to save investors from that kind of stuff. So good luck with that. And please follow up with us and let us know what happens. I'd love to hear a happy ending out of that I can, you know, announce on the show maybe in several months or next year. So please follow up and let us know about that. And I wish you luck. Okay, let's get to our Meet the Masters debrief. We'll talk about that for just a few minutes here. I've got a couple of our investment counselors. I couldn't get all of them at the same time, but I got a couple of them on the line with me here. And then we will go to David Rock and we'll talk about your brain at work. And folks, I have a stack of content. We have recorded so many great shows, but also just for my part of the shows, my introduction, my monologue portion, I am looking here on my desk at a stack of papers about maybe a little over 2 inches tall of things that I need to talk to you about on show number 251, 252, 253, and on. So a lot of stuff coming up on the Creating Wealth Show. Stay tuned, and we got a lot of stuff to cover in upcoming shows. So we'll go to our debrief on Meet the Masters and our guest today here in just a moment.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about investing in and managing income properties for college students, there's a show for that. If you want to learn how to get noticed online and in social media, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to save on life's largest expense, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know about America's crime of the century, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
Hey, just wanted to share some thoughts with you about our most recent Meet the Masters event. I've got Molly and Sarah on the line with me. And first of all, what an honor it is to do these events. We just so much appreciate all of you coming, and especially those of you who come every time. Repeat visitors are great. And all of those of you who flew from such far distances to come as well. So thank you for doing that. And also, it's now Tuesday after the event, and I've been catching up on my email. And thank you for all of the very kind emails, all of the nice words about the event and so forth. But just wanted to share a little debrief on that. And Sarah, what were your thoughts on the event?
Well, it was a great event as usual. A lot of new content. A quick special thanks to Robert coming all the way from Denver, Colorado. And also Brent and Brandon from Colorado came out and joined us again. And we had some guests from Pennsylvania and New York. So pretty big group of people traveling in from you know, far away. And we had a lot from Northern California as well. So thank you for everybody for coming out to our event. And, you know, Jason, another thing I noticed is that we had a lot of our clients who purchased with us 2-3 years ago come back and re-audit the event because they're seeing that, you know, now is definitely the time to be buying. The interest rates are low, the price points are low, and there's some great opportunity out there.
There certainly are great opportunities out there. You know, one of the things I said at the event is you certainly don't have to convince anyone to buy good income property anymore. It sells itself, no question about it. So fantastic event there. Molly, what were your thoughts?
I agree wholeheartedly with Sarah. I think that we had a lot of repeat visitors coming, investors, and there's always something new to learn. I think it was an awesome weekend.
Yeah, and we learn new stuff and we take all your evaluations into account. We read them all and always take that feedback to make the next event even better. So the next time we do a Meet the Masters event, and we do them twice a year, we will be taking all the evaluations into account in terms of the speakers, the subjects, the things that were presented, the time schedule, the format, the number of speakers. You know, one of the things that on this event, I don't know if people could really handle it, but we hosted a nice dinner on Friday evening. And one of the things I just got up and talked for just a quick moment at the dinner. But one of the things I said to everybody is I said, tomorrow, be ready because we go for 12 hours. We go from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. all day Saturday. And if you don't drink coffee or Red Bull or energy drinks, maybe you should start now because we want to have your mind sharp and be tuned in for the event. And we had 12 speakers on Saturday, as well as two game shows. And we'll talk maybe about the game shows in a minute. That was the first time that we did that. But I'm kind of thinking maybe 12 speakers was a little much for one day for Saturday, just too much information. But, you know, we'll continue to get your feedback. I mean, you're all telling me you liked it. We got some great tips on formatting and so forth. And even the sequence of the speakers and the way the topics are presented, we love getting your feedback on that too. But Molly and Sarah, do you think 12 speakers, was that too many or could people handle it? Was it too much to take in?
People handled it well. Sorry, Molly. I thought people handled it well. I think, you know, at the end of the event, the one piece of feedback that I got from everybody is, you know, the information was great, but there were so many great areas to choose from as, in terms of, you know, where to start purchasing. How do I choose which one to start with? And so, you know, I thought I would just encourage everybody who attended the weekend, you know, don't hesitate to call your investment counselor, either Molly, Ari, or myself. Give us a call and we will help you kind of narrow it down to a good starting point. You know, everybody has a different time horizon, different investment goals, and that's kind of what we're here for. We want to serve as an extra set of eyes and ears for you. Maybe we can point out some things that you didn't think of, and we're here to help.
Yeah, one thing I want to mention is, you know, again, on one of the evaluations, one of our attendees asked about the process. Like, I'd like to know more about the process of investing. And of course, there's more to it than this, but just a quick overview of how it works. Contact us through the website at jasonhartman.com. There are several different web forms and inlets there. Or you can call us at the phone number on the website as well and work with your investment counselor. And the process just becomes totally easy and apparent as you start talking and engaging with an investment counselor at our company. And they will usually talk to you about your, as Sarah alluded to, your time horizon, your risk tolerance, your investment goals, and all of those things, just using basic financial planning techniques, but applied to the most historically proven an asset class, income property, rather than crummy stocks, bonds, and mutual funds, and even precious metals. So we've got the right asset class, and we've got the process that is really proven, a financial planning type of process. That's our style, where we really look at the investor and what their goals are and what their needs are and what they're willing, what risk they're willing to take, because that helps us decide what markets to refer you to. And then usually our investment counselor will schedule a three-way conference call with you on the phone, the investment counselor from our company on the phone, and the local market specialist. And the local market specialist is what we call the ground troops. They're the person on the ground. You've heard them on the show before, and they can talk to you about specific inventory that they have at the time. They can even talk to you about private lending opportunities and hard money lending opportunities in some of the markets. We can help you use your 401k to invest. We can help you use your IRA to invest. We can help you use home equity to invest, or just money in your savings accounts or stock accounts. So there's a lot of ways you can approach this. There's a lot of strategy to it. And there's even strategy as to when you're buying many, many properties. We've got clients that plan to buy 20, 30, 40, 50 properties from us, and how you sequence the mortgages and how you do that right. And there's a lot to it. And you don't need to know it all or hear it all at the Meet the Masters event or even on the show here. We will guide you through that process as it unfolds. And the reason maybe we can't even and share it all from the stage or on the show is because it's different for everybody. That's one of the things to consider. And, you know, Sarah, you get a lot of questions about that. You may have something to add to what I just said.
No, I mean, you summarized that pretty well. You know, it's just some people, they leave the event so excited and ready to start, but they kind of get in their own way in the sense that, you know, they don't pick up the phone and make that first call or that initial contact because they're not sure who to call. So just know that we're here to help you. We're here to work with you on your own time horizon, you know, whether it's, you know, 1 to 3 months, 3 to 6 months, next year, you know, we'll continue to work with you, you know, and help you get your ducks in a row so that you're ready to go. And getting over that first property is usually the challenging thing. And then after that, it sort of becomes this addiction, as many of our investors agree with, you know, you can't wait to get your hands on the next one. So let us help you get over that hurdle. You know, that's what we're here for.
Well, and they work so well. I mean, this just works, this asset class. It's not perfect. But one of the things I said at the weekend is I said, it's not perfect. It has its problems. It has its pitfalls. But the question every investor needs to ask themselves is this: compared to what? In other words, compared to what? What else are you going to do with your money? You have got to put your money to work for you so that it is earning its highest possible return. Don't have lazy money. Don't have sleepy equity sitting in your house doing nothing for you. I cannot tell you the number of people who have come to us, who have been investing with us sometimes for many years, and they say, gosh, I am so glad I followed this plan. I am so glad I put my money to work. I'm so glad I put the equity in my house to work. I'm so glad I put my IRA to work. I'm so glad I'm a direct investor so that I have control. So I'm not leaving my financial future in somebody else's hands. And folks, that's just really important. Get in control of your future and your financial life, because some people out there feel like this is a recovery we're in. And I don't think it's a recovery, really. It's a recovery for some. It's certainly a recovery for the elite class, the banksters, the Wall Street elite, the political elite. But for the rest of us, it's not a recovery, okay? And it's amazing, though, how quickly, within just a couple of short years, you can turn your whole financial life around just by making a few good decisions. A few good decisions multiplied out into the future, a few hundred days even, 300, 400, 500 days in the future, it can really change things for you. It's unbelievable how quickly that time goes by and what you can do with it. I want to wrap up here, but other thoughts on the event, either of you? Molly, maybe?
Yeah, I just wanted to read to you guys an email that I received from one of my investors. It's a little shout out to Platinum Properties. And he stated, I just wanted to let you know that I know one of your local market specialists through you and another investor network. I actually heard of the local market specialists on my own, but wasn't able to contact them. However, I'm definitely planning to buy through you guys moving forward. I like you guys much better than the other investor network. So I think that just speaks volumes for our weekend, for our team, and for everything that we have to offer all of our investors.
It's really reaffirming and great to hear stuff like that. And you know, I got to tell you, I hear stuff like that all the time. So thank you for sharing that, Molly. One of the things, I think we really have a different business philosophy in so many ways. Remember, our slogan is the complete solution for real estate investors, the complete solution for real estate investors. And with that slogan, we really live by it. And one of the things I actually mentioned in my closing at the Meet the Masters event is that we love problems. Bring us a problem and we love it because we know it's a chance to win you as a client, to win you over. And so bring on the problems. I remember reading back when I read a book many years ago called The IBM Way. And they talked about the way IBM did business when it was in its heyday. Of course, IBM's not the same company it was back then, but back in its day, it was like America's flagship company. And in the IBM Way, they talked about how when a customer had a problem, IBM staff would just descend on that customer and just take care of their problem. And they knew that that was the time when the sale was really made. It wasn't at the time the customer bought the computer system or the mainframe, because that's the olden days we're talking about. It was at the time IBM solved the problem for the customer. So bring on your problems. We love them because we know it is a chance to help make you a loyal customer for life and to get a lot of referrals. So we're obviously in this to have a good business and to create good incomes for ourselves and to be successful. But we know we can only do that by making you successful. You know, Zig Ziglar said, you can have everything in life you want if you just help enough other people get what they want.
Well, I was just going to add in on the helping your clients through their challenges point. You know, quick funny little story. On Sunday, I sat down at a table for lunch with three investors. And as soon as I sat down, I realized that this conversation may not go well, because there were two of them that, you know, they had a couple challenges because they, you know, they're longtime investors. They bought many properties and they had challenges on each had challenges on one of their properties, you know, that we helped them through. But in getting through, and by the way, there was one new investor that had, you know, never purchased through our network. So I was just really kind of bracing myself for this lunch. But it was great, because the new investor got to hear, you know, some of the challenges that occurred. They got to hear how we helped them through it. You know, it actually made us look good, because we were there, you know, to support them. And it was just a great networking opportunity for these investors and a great learning experience. So, you know, that's the other aspect of Meet the Masters, is just, you know, the networking alone is just so powerful.
One of the things that I always hear from our local market specialists and from people who attend our live events, they say, I went to another club, I've been to another real estate group, I've been to other meetings, and what strikes me about your group, or not your group like us, the way we present ourselves, but the people in the audience, and attendees say that, but then local market specialists that we refer business to, our providers in different parts of the country that provide the property for us, they say this to me, and this is a recurring theme, I've heard it for a long time. They say, your clients are the most sophisticated clients that I have ever worked with of any group. And I think one of the reasons we're attracting a more sophisticated clientele is because we are transparent. We don't sugarcoat this stuff. We know that it is not problem-free. It is just, the question is, compared to what? It's just better than everything else. There's a funny saying, capitalism isn't perfect. It's just better than everything else. And that's what we say about income property. It isn't perfect. It's just better than everything else. And, you know, we educate people. We are transparent. And our assumptions on our performas are conservative and real world realistic. So I think those factors are what really bring a more sophisticated clientele. Because if you have a really dumb clientele, you know, you can be used car salesman, you can be cheesy, and you can be unprofessional, and you can pull the wool over someone's eyes, and you can slam deals together, throw the mud against the wall and see what sticks. But these are low price properties, folks. We don't make a lot of money on every transaction. We depend on repeat business, just like a restaurant. And so that's really the key. And, you know, we're in this for the long haul. I love this business. My goal is really just to save the middle class. So that's what we're here for, to help investors really create wealth and have a secure retirement through income property. Any other thoughts before we wrap up?
No, not for me. I think we summed it up pretty well. And, you know, thank you so much for putting on the event. I personally learn something new each time I attend and really enjoy the company as well. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's great networking opportunity. And Sarah, it's amazing. You sit in the room and you listen attentively to every single event. I mean, you must be so sick of hearing me talk. I can't even believe it after all this time. But I really commend you for that. And it's great networking with all our clients and just having these live events. Live events are a lot of work for us. It's a lot easier to do the show, the podcast. But we really want to touch base eye to eye and shake hands with all our investors a couple times a year. So that's why we do it. And you know what we're planning now? We are working on planning a tour in one of our markets where we'll do the Creating Wealth Boot Camp maybe on a Saturday and then a tour on a Sunday. So stay tuned for that. We've been thinking about it. A few people even suggested it last weekend at Meet the Masters. That's what we're working on, and we'll talk about that on a future show. So thanks so much again for attending, and let's get back to the show. My pleasure to welcome Dr. David Rock to the show. He is the author of Your Brain at Work, Strategies for Overcoming Distraction, Regaining Focus, and Working Smarter All Day Long. I know this is a topic we can all benefit from, especially yours truly, so I think this will be an interesting interview. David is co-founder and director of the NeuroLeadership Institute, and they are all about breaking new ground in our capacity to improve thinking and performance, and he is also founder and CEO of Results Coaching Systems. David, welcome. How are you?
Very good. Thanks very much for your interest in my work.
Good. And you're coming to us from New York City, right?
I am. I'm in lovely downtown Manhattan where I live. And although I'm originally Australian, but I live in New York City. It's a great city.
We would have never guessed that from your accent. Just kidding. Fantastic accent. So, David, tell us a little bit about how we can be more effective. I mean, everybody, especially in today's world, is constantly plagued by distractions, complexities, and it's tough to focus nowadays with looking at multiple computer screens, and then you've got your digital handheld device near you, probably, and plus the people in the room. There's a lot going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, our brain is really very, very different to how the people who organize companies would like it to be. Our brain is not the brain that sort of interior designers think it is. We cannot focus with just, you know, a few people looking at us. Never mind bouncing screens. You know, we can't focus very well at all if we're aware people are watching us. We can't focus very well if there's just a printer icon, you know, flashing on our screen. It's very, very easy to distract people from, especially from a train of thought that is kind of conceptual. You know, when something's right in front of you, you can think about it, you can talk about it. When something's conceptual, like it's in the future or you haven't seen it before, it's a concept like an interest rate or a new product or a new hire or a concepts don't sit very well in the brain. So they take a lot of effort to hold and they're very easily displaced because they take so much effort. So it's very, very difficult to focus on the kind of conceptual work we're all doing with any kind of distraction. And the truth is, you know, companies are making some shocking mistakes with how they just, you know, physically lay out and organize kind of spaces.
Very interesting. So you're saying, I just wanted to touch on the concept point that you made, because I'm not sure people understand what you mean by concept. So you mean, as opposed to task-oriented thinking, that's much simpler, whereas conceptual thinking, our brains need to put multiple parts together and project them into the future, and that's much more taxing on the brain. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's more like this. You know, if I say to you, picture your mother, she's going to come to mind pretty easily. And if I ask you questions about your relationship with your mother, you know, you can think about that easily. If I say picture your car, you can picture that pretty easily. Or picture an elephant, you know, you can picture that pretty easily. But if I say, you know, picture where you'll be in 3 months' time.
That's much harder to picture, right.
It's much harder. It's a concept. It's not a physical object in the world, and when we process any kind of information, we have to hold it in mind. And holding something in mind has essentially two parts. It's called working memory. It has two parts. There's an audio and a visual part, basically. The visual working memory is dramatically more robust. There's a lot more circuitry involved, and you can hold a lot more information in a picture than you can in a sound. And so our visual circuitry is really strong, but when you can't picture something easily, you don't have a robust circuit. And so it takes a lot of effort to hold that circuit in mind. You know, say to you, picture where you'll be in 3 months, and then, you know, a phone rings next to you, and you've suddenly lost your train of thought. You're much more likely to lose that train of thought than if I say, you know, picture your car. You'll be able to hold that train of thought through the distraction. And it's the level of effort involved in holding a circuit together. So essentially, we're dealing in concepts these days. You know, very few people sell or sort of, you know, pick up and move or deal with physical objects in the world so much. We're dealing with concepts.
Right, services and things like that. Right, yeah, that's a good point.
Exactly,
yeah.
Things we don't see. So it's much harder to process all that.
So that's interesting. First, maybe you can tell us about, when you talk about how workspace is laid out for people, what mistakes do you see individuals and companies making as in terms of how they lay out their workspace? What keeps them from being focused?
Yeah. I mean, it's an excellent question. We did a survey recently with an organization, and we got 6,000 employees to respond to a set of questions about physical space. But the biggest insight came from the sort of overarching question. And we asked people, you know, how many of you do your best thinking at work? And just to bear in mind, this is in a company, I won't say who it is, but it's in a company where people are, you know, really paid to think. So they go to work, they're supposed to be thinking. So literally in the place where they're supposed to be doing their work, I've asked them the question, how many of you actually can do quality work at that place? And the answer was 10%. So 1 in 10 people could, you know, actually find going to work was a good place to get work done. That's crazy, right?
Yeah, terrible. <It's insane. laughs> Bad odds.
It's insane. Yeah. I mean, you should just close the office and let people come in one in every 10 days, perhaps, or 1 in every 10 people should come in. I don't know what, but it's crazy when you think about it. So I wrote a blog called, or a post called, How Companies Spend Big Dollars Making People Less Effective. And there's a lot of organizations that really don't understand the basic nature of human functioning and do some crazy things. Now, Steve Jobs has been in the media a lot lately, and he's a, you know, he's an amazing man for many, many reasons. But one of the things that he is not talked about much is he was an observer of human nature. He was a meditator and into all sorts of kind of spiritual things. But what he was ultimately about was observing human nature, and he was very successful at noticing quirks that other people didn't notice, such as, you know, people like things really simple. People don't want to have to think. You know, we like stuff to be, you know, intuitive and natural. Now, certainly there are boffins around, but you know, he observed human functioning. Now, if you go into an office and observe human behavior, what you'll see is in any kind of office that's even vaguely open plan, you'll see everyone with their headsets in trying to shut out the world so they can focus. And if you ask people sort of, if you observe across a day, you'll notice that people are doing a couple of hours of sort of really good work in the morning, and then that's pretty much it for the day. So there are pretty obvious patterns that, you know, we need to be able to shut the world out, and we can only really do good quality work for a few hours a day in the mornings. So it's sort of, you know, it starts to have you question, well, how should we design companies physically if that's the way the human brain functions? And the answer is, you know, we should not schedule meetings and not be answering emails in the morning. In the mornings, we should be leaving that time for creative work and actually producing things. And we should use the afternoons for meetings to, you know, help each other stay awake. And we should also allow people the physical space to be absolutely totally undisturbed by anything, and be able to sort of move through, you know, have that option to be totally undisturbed.
You know, that's interesting, so because you know, people, I mean, most people, I don't know if it's just me, but I think most people, the first thing they sort of do when they start their day is they manage all their email. And that's pretty task-oriented, though. I guess it requires, you know, sometimes the emails, you need to respond in a creative fashion or think about what someone sent you, of course. But maybe that's not the highest and best use for that prime time of our brain power, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the golden rule is do creative work first, urgent and important second, and email and everything else third. And the reason's a bit complex, but essentially creative work requires a lot of space in your brain. It requires a lot of quiet in your brain. You know, we have insights when our brain is quiet, when we can notice subtle connections between things, weak connections between things. And so you know, doing emails is sort of like doing, you know, 50 push-ups, and you've only, you know, in terms of mentally, and you're actually, you know, absolutely exhausted afterwards. And then you go to do, you know, some other exercise, and you haven't got much left in you. Creative work first, urgent, important second, and everything else after.
So most people need to flip their day around, I'd assume, listening to this. What about the physical space? You know, I assume you're going to say keep it a sort of simple, zen-like environment, not a lot of things to look at, maybe, or no. You know, I mean, I see a lot of workspaces of companies that seem to be pretty effective, and they seem like they have whiteboards all over. Some of them paint them on the walls. There's writing all over them. Everything's kind of like, you know, there's that sort of war room type concept of the environment where it's like a war room and you've just got bulletin boards up, things stuck up on the walls, a lot of stuff to look at, storyboarding, whatever. And then there's the decorated type of office where it's maybe clean and simple and nicely decorated. Is one more right than the other? Or by what you're saying, it would seem like the war room is a really bad idea.
Well, you know, it depends on the kind of work you're trying to do. And little things actually matter more than we realize when it comes to the physical space and just the brain overall. You know, really, little things really do matter, it turns out. So, for example, if you paint a room blue, people will be much more creative. A high ceiling makes people much more creative. You know, there's a lot of little things like that actually help. They prime the brain. You know, I saw a study today which showed that just changing rooms, you know, when you move rooms, it's much harder to access memories that you formed in the previous room. There's all sorts of kind of quirky things that go on. But essentially, if you're looking for, one size fits all, the best answer I can give you is let people design their own space. And there's a great study showing you get about a third increase in productivity when you let people design their own workspace, which is crazy. And the companies say, well, let's design it for them. Let's find, one approach. But a third increase in productivity, that's quite a lot, 30%, 33%. Literally just, how do you want your space to look? Just personalize it. And some people really need it clean and absolutely zen. Some people want their family everywhere on the walls. Some people want 5 desks and a war room thing. And, every brain's really different. And giving people the autonomy to make these kind of choices actually is a reward unto itself. But people have different needs when it comes to that physical space as well. So the best rule is don't have one, is let people create the spaces themselves.
But that's interesting what you said about blue. I mean, there have been a lot of studies that I've heard about that show that, like, pink is the color of calmness, and they're painting prisons where there's a bunch of hardened criminals. You know, they're painting the insides of them pink in many cases to calm everybody down so they're not violent, But is blue the color of
violent? I'm trying to imagine the criminals. They're not violent, but they're deeply embarrassed, probably.
Right, well, maybe.
Imagine going to jail. Imagine going to jail and having to say in a pink cell. You'd be too embarrassed to be violent. It's funny.
There you go. Is blue the color of creativity, though?
It is. Yeah. It's partly to do with the proximity effects. You know, when you feel like you can see at a distance. And you feel like you can see a long way, and you're not, you actually, it's weird, but it primes your brain to think literally big thoughts. You know, when you're looking at the sky rather than a roof, your brain is able to sort of think further out, think bigger thoughts, think more systemically. It primes your brain.
I think a lot of people listening may want to paint, get some blue paint. So just before we leave this small little subject here that seems really important, is there a certain shade of blue? Is it sky blue? Is that the right color, or navy? Or
I don't want to be too prescriptive. I think people should do their own research on that.
Okay.
Something that is pleasing to the eye is, of course, really important. And that may vary.
Sure. What are some of the things people can do to find insights and solve seemingly insurmountable problems? The problem that there's no seemingly right solution. How does one get their mind in a place where they can solve these types of problems?
The answer to that is really fascinating and confounding. I mean, there's really two brains. We've really got two brains. We've got a conscious brain and a non-conscious brain. And being talked about by a lot of people, lots of different frameworks, the elephant and the rider and the high road and the low road, all sorts of things. But essentially, we have a conscious brain and a non-conscious brain. And, when we can't solve a problem, the conscious brain goes round and round in circles on the same small set of solutions. We kind of get stuck in the same small set of solutions and not get anywhere. And what's really interesting is those breakthrough moments when we suddenly have this kind of aha. It's something I've studied a lot for about 5 years. We know a lot now about these breakthrough moments. They actually happen when the brain is quiet and when we're not consciously trying to solve the problem. We've got to have sort of thought about the question, but trying to consciously solve a problem once we've failed actually is going to reduce the likelihood of insight, interestingly. So what we know is quieting the brain, going a little bit internal, being slightly happy, but not working directly on the problem, working around it. This is the kind of state we need to be in to solve these tough problems. I wrote a paper about this, but if you look up online just how to have more insights, you'll see my post on Psychology Today on that, how to have more insights. And it's, we really know a lot now about the neural state of a brain that has these breakthroughs. And there's no substitute for quiet in the brain. And quiet literally means not a lot of electrical activity going on. So it's that state you have in the shower in the morning when you first wake up, but you won't have that if you do your emails before the shower. You know, your brain will be ticking over. So it's that quiet brain. That's when we have those breakthrough moments, and kind of respecting those quiet spaces in the day and allowing the insights to come from the non-conscious brain into the conscious brain. That's how we tend to solve those tough problems.
Yeah, very good point. How can we be more effective in collaborative situations where we really need to collaborate and harvest ideas from others and be engaged in that exchange?
You know, there's a big body of work in this area. There's a whole field called social cognitive neuroscience, and there are a whole bunch of neuroscientists, probably about 500 of them now, that are studying how people interact and what happens when we try to collaborate. And I built a model that summarizes what goes on in the collaborative situations, and it's been really, really helpful for understanding kind of what goes wrong a lot of the time. And it's basically, there are five domains that the brain is tracking all the time, and with these five domains, it's really important that we don't get a threat response in any of these domains. For example, status is the first one. You know, when we feel like our status is going down, when we feel like it's getting worse, we react very, very intensely. And what the neuroscientists are finding is that something like a status threat or an autonomy threat or a threat to a sense of relatedness to someone or a fairness threat, these threats actually are A, very, very strong, and B, they activate the brain's pain network. So, you know, feeling like someone's attacking your status actually feels in the brain like someone's attacking you with a knife, and you defend yourself accordingly. You defend yourself very, very vigorously. And most of this goes on non-consciously. So the five domains are status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. And those five spell out a framework called SCARF. And SCARF, or in American it's SCARF, SCARF is these five domains that either can be in a threat or be in a reward state. So you can have an increase in status that feels really motivating, and it's very, very motivating to feel better than other people. It's very, very motivating to increase your sense of certainty. It's very motivating to increase your sense of relatedness, et cetera. So these five domains are being played out in social situations, and when things go wrong, it's usually one of these five that's come unstuck without people being aware of it.
So certainly then what you're saying is, if you're leading a team, the simple old concepts of positive strokes, of complimenting and rewarding and all that kind of stuff, I mean, that's neurologically important is what you're saying.
It's critical. It's critical. And the reason it's critical is that our conscious mind is really, really limited and not that effective on many levels. And, you know, anything we can do to increase our conscious capacity, our conscious processing capacity is helpful. Bear in mind that few people can even add up four single digits in their head. You know, that's not much information. If I say to you, what's 56 plus 79? You know, you could probably do it, but you'd rather not. And just, you know, adding up four digits is a threshold at which, you know, most people sort of can't do things. Or some can, but certainly most people don't want to. And so making things easy for people turns out to be very important, because we've got so little processing power, particularly for new ideas. We can process existing thoughts, existing habits very easily, but new ideas take a lot of processing power and they get kind of shunted aside a lot, which is why, you know, change is hard as well.
But you're saying make it easy, but is the brain like a muscle where it needs exercise and it atrophies if it doesn't exercise? I mean, do you want to challenge? Don't you want to challenge the brain? Play chess, do crossword puzzles, or, you know, whatever, music?
Yeah, I mean, there's a use it or lose it thing. There's no question there's a use it or lose it in the brain. It's not a muscle, but it's definitely, it's definitely something that most functions improve with use.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
Jason provides an extremely unique service, Deal Evaluator. Are you interested in a property outside of our network? Need a second opinion? No problem. Let our experts evaluate the deal. Find out more about it at jasonhartman.com.
You kind of alluded to it earlier, but in terms of when one feels their status is threatened, they become less effective. Does that lead into any more thoughts on keeping one's cool under pressure, under any situation?
Yeah, I mean, the big takeaway from the brain research is that emotions do really matter. And even low levels of stress have a surprisingly large effect on our cognitive capability. And, you know, learning how to regulate your own emotions by recognizing them, being able to intervene quickly, whether it's distracting your attention or changing your interpretation of situations, you know, doing these things quickly is really, really key. And what we know is from neuroscience is that even really small threat responses, something primed that people don't even know they feel, really small threat responses actually reduce cognitive capacity in a big way, especially around creativity. You can get a 50% reduction in creativity with a threat response people don't even know they're feeling. And so small things really matter when it comes to effectiveness. I mentioned this earlier. This is one of the kind of big findings from big overall findings. I guess it's a generalization, but we have less control over ourselves and others than we probably realize, but more influence, far more influence in little ways over ourselves and others, but far, far less control.
You approach it from the angle of maybe a manager or a leader in leading a group, and it's important not to threaten one's status and things like that. But if someone needs to, say, get over something, or forgive and forget, or process emotions, I mean, can one do that more quickly? I mean, is it true that one can, a lot of people say, you know, I need to just process these emotions, and then I'll be over it. I mean, how does one do that? Is that really a thing people truly do at the neuroscientific level, or is it just something they talk about?
No, there's a process called reappraisal, which has been very well studied in the neuroscience lab. And reappraisal is where you change your whole meaning about a situation. And we do it all the time, mostly we're not aware of it. But it's a very, very important skill for dealing with strong stresses. It's really the only skill you can use for something that's quite stressful. Like you lose your job, you know, you might start spiraling down into a stress response that really, really, you know, affects your life, to depression, all sorts of things. But if you can reappraise, if you're able to reappraise the situation, you might be able to change that. You could reappraise it as an opportunity to decide, you know, what's really important, you know, for your career next, or an opportunity to get really healthy and connect to your family for a while, or an opportunity to downsize and simplify your life, or, you know, something that's got to make sense to you. But neuroscientists have been looking at what happens when we change our interpretation of the situation, and a whole emotional response follows, our whole biological response follows when we change an interpretation. So it's pretty important stuff.
Yeah, that's very good feedback. You talked at the beginning about how difficult and how much brain power it takes to comprehend conceptual things. And I want to tie this into, you know, a discussion about something that has been repackaged and rewrapped as recently as 4 years ago or so. And that is the law of attraction concept, the secret. That's been around forever, basically, but it regained a lot of fame recently. And what one has to do when they make a goal for themselves is they have to visualize something that they don't yet have. It has to be projected into the future, but they need to make it seem like it's real today so that it's sort of the subconscious mind can grasp it, maybe. I mean, I'm kind of saying a lot of things here, so interrupt me when I'm wrong or correct me. But is this why it's so hard to set and achieve goals, is because one has to get their head around a concept that isn't there yet? Like you said, it's grasping a concept. It takes a lot more power than a physical thing.
That's partly it. And there's been some good studies on the fact that the more a goal is proximal, or the more a goal feels close to you, you know, both physically and in time, the more motivated you are. There's been some people researching that. So, yeah, definitely, you know, goals that are really in the future, intangible, it's hard to picture them. When we can't picture something, we don't have the emotional response to it as strong as when we can picture it. It's all very well, if I say the word lion, you're not going to get much of a response. But if you actually picture a lion sort of about to jump at you, or we showed you a picture of that physically, a picture, you know, you'd get a biological response. So, you know, hearing something doesn't get a strong response, seeing it really does, back to that first point. So
visual. So when they say the concept of visualization, of course, you want to maybe, quote unquote, visualize a goal with as many senses as possible and as much sensory input as possible. But really, vision, that is, without a doubt, our richest sense. right? Far beyond our hearing and our touch and everything else. It's visual is the biggie, right?
Absolutely. And people will say, oh, I'm a visual person, or I'm an auditory person, or, you know, I've got this learning style. Learning styles has been debunked. There's no such thing as learning styles. There are definitely tendencies, and people have preferences. Use an iPhone for a month and you've got a definite tendency to prefer using iPhones. You know, it's just a habit that you've got. That doesn't mean you've got an iPhone-style brain. So something you do over and over will become a bit of a tendency. But in the brain, there are two ways of processing data, you know, audio and visual. That's what we have. And the visual just holds so much more information. And in the brain, it's a huge amount more real estate. It's like an enormous shopping mall versus a single store in terms of kind of square footage. So, you know, your visual is a huge shopping mall and the auditory is a single store. So there's a lot more connections you can make, a lot more neurons involved, a lot more circuits created when you hold visual than when you hold a sound.
That's interesting, and I want to believe in every way that that's absolutely correct. The only area that I'd sort of question is the power of music being so powerful, and you know that's auditory, so it's kind of interesting.
But no, it has an impact.
I guess the best songs though make people visualize stuff.
Well, that's true as well. I mean, it's not to say that sounds aren't effective. I mean, I could play you all sorts of sounds in the lab that would make your hair curl. I mean, you know, the sound of fingernails on a chalkboard will definitely have an emotional impact on people. So there are visuals that are impactful and there are sounds that are impactful. Can't so much compare them, but when it comes to the strength of a circuit, it's just the physical real estate is much, much stronger. So I think with goals, there's a number of challenges with goals. One is we often can't see them and we don't sort of, they're too off in the distance. And another challenge is we often set goals in a negative way. We set avoidance goals instead of approach goals. And we need to really learn to set approach goals that we go towards rather than away from.
Yeah, very good point. Couple last things here before we wrap up. Providing feedback to people, that can be difficult. And trying, and maybe it's not possible at all, I don't know what you're going to say, but is it possible or can we be more effective at changing other people's behavior? So feedback and changing other people's behavior. I think bosses and parents are going to want to perk up at those two.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we all want to tell people how to fix themselves, and it's a great way of creating a status threat and,
right.
You know, having people shut down. You know, my framework for feedback is actually don't give feedback unless it's positive. Give self-directed feed forward, which is help people give themselves feedback about the way forward. And it's just a much more effective way of creating behavior change than you know, telling people what they've done wrong.
Can you give an example of that? That was a really interesting statement
you made. Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you go to a sales meeting with someone, you know, you're managing a salesperson, you go to the sales meeting, and they haven't done so great, and you come out afterwards and you start telling them all the things they'll do wrong, and they'll argue with you and will feel really bad or whatever. But instead of that, you can give self-directed feed forward, which is you can say to the person, you know, if you were doing that again, you know, you're a smart person, you probably learn a lot all the time. If you're going to do that again, what would you do differently next time? What learning did you take out of that? And by giving people a chance to kind of tell on themselves around this, you get a whole different set of circuits created, and it's a reward response instead of a threat response. So it's a different, you know, it's a qualitatively different experience to do self-directed feed forward than feedback. One creates a threat and shuts people down. One creates a reward and hopefully creates new connections. And it doesn't mean it works every time, but we find about 3/4 of the time this approach works, which means, you know, you've got a lot less. It means you've got 25% as many arguments as happens now.
Very good point. So the book is entitled Your Brain at Work: Strategies for Overcoming Distraction, Regaining Focus, and Working Smarter All Day Long. David, tell people where they can learn more.
Neuroleadership.com. Neuroleadership.com has the programs that I offer on the brain and coaching programs, learning to be a certified coach and work we do with organizations. And neuroleadership.org. Neuroleadership.org has a whole range of programs for individuals to discover the brain as change agents. So there's a postgraduate certificate, master's degree, things like that. There's also an annual summit that we run at neuroleadership.org. So a couple of different sites, the academic and research side, neuroleadership.org, neuroleadership.com, more the commercial side and organizational work. And then my own site, davidrock.net, for all the papers that I've written and books I've published, etc. So there's a few resources for you there to enjoy.
Fantastic. Dr. David Rock, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate having you on the show.
Thanks so much for your interest in this work. All the best.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.